Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, February 16th, 2016. Remember back in March of 2003 when W said we just had to invade Iraq because they had weapons of mass destruction?
Back in the days of shock and awe, we came to liberate them all. History was a cruel judge of overconfidence. Back in the days of shock and awe.
Well, Neil Young remembers. And among the Republicans, the only candidate for president who doesn't have amnesia about the blunder of invading Iraq is the guy with the wacky hair. And while all eyes were focused on the Republican candidates and their lockstep reaction to the death of Antonin Scalia and the demand that Obama not appoint his successor, the real blockbuster, the little bomb that was detonated, the stink bomb from a Republican point of view, during the debate on Saturday night, was when Donald Trump went after Jeb Bush, saying, look, your brother not only blundered us into the war in Iraq and lied about the WMDs, he said he was on duty for 9/11. He was responsible for 9/11. And the audience of the debate, filled with establishment Republicans, gasped and booed and could not believe the truthiness that Donald Trump was trotting out. And so this does go down as a watershed moment in Republican political history in this country, because Donald Trump spoke the truth. And George W. Bush, who is campaigning for his brother in South Carolina these days, got off entirely scot-free over 9/11. Marco Rubio in the debate blamed it on Bill Clinton for failing to snuff out Osama bin Laden before that. And this is pure Republican revisionism. And I'm loath to praise Donald Trump for anything, but when I watched this, I was cheering. And, of course, the Republicans responded by closing ranks behind Jeb Bush. Jeb cited his dad and his mom and inferred that because of their greatness that W is a wonderful human being as well. It was bizarre. And it shows how detached from reality most of the Republicans are. And how can you take on the Islamic State if you're not honest about the history of where they came from? And how our entry into the war in Iraq was the biggest blunder in recent history. And Donald Trump is the only Republican who can actually say it. So W went on the campaign trail. He's much shorter than his little brother, which is always a kind of a visual surprise for people. But W said, well, there seems to be a lot of name-calling going on, but I want to remind you what our good dad told me one time. Labels are for soup cans. The presidency is a serious job that requires sound judgment and good ideas. And there's no doubt in my mind that Jeb Bush has the experience and the character to be a great president. Now, here's the guy who failed in all these tests of leadership. And he is saying that his brother has sound judgment and good ideas. And W didn't have sound judgment, didn't have good ideas, was captive to Dick Cheney, who's out there attacking Trump today, too. Now, today, Trump went even further. He mocked W for the mission accomplished appearance on the aircraft carrier, where the president co-piloted a plane onto the deck of the aircraft carrier, hopped out in a flight suit that appeared to enhance his crotch, and then claimed that victory was in hand. And, of course, that was not the case. It was a premature ejaculation on the part of President Bush at that time. So Trump also raised 9/11 again. What does that mean? He kept the country safe after 9/11. What about during 9/11? I was there. The worst attack ever in this country was during his presidency. And he added that praising the former president for what happened after the September 11th attacks was like saying the opposing team scored 19 runs in the first inning, but after that, we played pretty well. So this is producing an interesting split, because right-wing radio hosts like Rush Limbaugh and Mark Levin, who were basically going along with Trump because he's a disruptor, because he's taking on the establishment, now suddenly they're pulling in their wings. And Limbaugh compared Trump to Michael Moore today. That's a Jeb Bush talking point that somebody probably passed along to L. Rushbo. And so this is, in many ways, it's sick and tragic and twisted, but it's delightful and delicious all at the same time. And so I think that was, as I say, a defining moment in this bizarre Republican campaign for president. Trump also was interviewed by the psychotic right-wing radio host based here in San Francisco, Michael Savage, and Savage asked him about the circumstances of the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. And as you may know, the owner of the high-end hunting resort, the hunting lodge, where the justice reportedly expired, I think it's fair to say it's accurate, he did expire there, but we don't know how. And the owner said that they found, when they opened his room and found him lying there dead, that he had his pillow over his face. Now, a lot of people are trying to make a lot out of this. And I, for one, support any investigation. There has been no autopsy. He was pronounced dead by a justice of the peace via telephone. She wasn't even there. And so this is a very slipshod process for dealing with the untimely and so far unexplained death of Justice Scalia. And at minimum, we should have an autopsy and determine a cause of death. I, for one, am not prepared to engage in theories about foul play. I sometimes put my pillow over my face if the room is too light and I'm not ready to wake up. And I have never, lost breathing or become asphyxiated because I had my pillow over my head. Now, if somebody came in and killed the justice by suffocating him with a pillow, we would probably see signs of struggle. And it's likely that the perpetrator would not have left the pillow over the face of the now dead justice. So I'm skeptical, as always. I'm skeptical of the official story, but I'm also skeptical of the somewhat hilarious and hysterical commentary that has surfaced so far. I spent about 5 minutes watching an Alex Jones video that he posted just a few hours after the death of Scalia. And not only was he suggesting that Scalia had been killed, but that this is part of a huge plot where the Constitution is going to be suspended later this year and we're going to descend into some sort of martial law. Frankly, he spins up things in such a complex and interconnected way that I find him hard to follow. And I do not extend much credibility to Alex Jones. He is occasionally right. He is occasionally on target when he exposes state crimes. But he spins up so many theories in such an irresponsible and hyperbolic way that I simply don't have much confidence in the reporting that he does. The Republicans are really forming a solid front in this obstructionist approach, saying that Obama should not appoint Scalia's successor. And the rationales that they offer are bizarre. Many of them just claim that this extremely liberal president simply is not qualified to appoint the conservative that everybody knows the nation wants and deserves to fill the seat of Antonin Scalia. And they are doing backflips and really hurting themselves as they try to build a case saying that with 9 months or 10 months left, that Obama should refrain from appointing a replacement. Now, not only is this impractical because there are critical cases that the court is going to be deciding this year, but it is historically not consistent. Now, I do have to say that the GOP and its attack machinery has a very great soundbite or a series of soundbites that they can use to try to project hypocrisy on the Democrats. And it's fair to say that there's always gamesmanship in Washington. But there are soundbites of Chuck Schumer, who, when George W. Bush had less than 18 months to run as president, announced that he was going to do everything he could to block confirmation of Bush's judicial appointees, including to the Supreme Court. And I don't support that coming from Chuck Schumer against a Republican president any more than I support what the Republicans are trying to play Obama for in this current context. So, to me, the process here is going to go forward. These Republican comments are bluffs. When the president presents a nominee, I think, as I explained in my brief podcast on President's Day yesterday, that he is going to find someone he can appoint who the Republicans cannot reject. And I've mentioned this one gentleman named Sri Srinivasan. He's a corporate litigator who was appointed to a federal bench last summer, and he was confirmed by the Senate 97-0. And unless he has put out a ruling that the Republicans can use to slit his throat with, he is the kind of candidate that is going to present a real challenge to the Republicans to hold this line. So I don't put much stock in the dramatic posturing that the Republicans are using right now. It's mostly for the consumption of their Republican base during the primary season. And like so many issues, they are likely to bend or change their position as they come to grips with reality down the road. But we shall see. There is another side to the presidential race, and that, of course, is Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders in the primary. The Clinton team is really going all out to attack Sanders. They appear to want to wipe him out as soon as possible, and they clearly fear the rising poll numbers that he's showing, the success in Iowa and New Hampshire, and they're responding. The latest attack line is that he is a single-issue candidate. And my friend, buddy, Thomas Frank, who wrote What's the Matter with Kansas, he has finally come out of hibernation. He has declined my invitations to return to the program because he has feverishly been working to finish his new book, which is called Listen Liberal. And it's going to be out next month, and we're in line to get a book and to get an interview with Mr. Frank. He published a commentary at The Guardian today, and he basically takes on the corporate media and the way the Sanders-Clinton campaigns are being framed. And he says that the voters are rejecting not Hillary the capable. They are rejecting the party whose leadership faction she represents, as well as the direction in which our modern Democrats have been traveling for decades. Now, this is Tom Frank's strong suit. He is a great expert on the history of American politics in the 20th century and has really used that effectively in his books and columns. And what he says is that Democrats turned away under Bill Clinton from the what was supposedly the obsolete legacy of FDR's New Deal with its fixation on working class people. What had to be embraced, the party's reformers agreed in the 90s, was the emerging post-industrial economy, and in particular the winners of the new order, the highly educated professionals who populated its clean and innovative knowledge industries. And he fingers Bill Clinton, who installed a new kind of democratic administration in Washington, reforming welfare, doing favors for the financial industry. And Frank says the Clintonian consensus, which slouches on in the bank bailouts and trade deals of recent years, is what deserves to be on the table this year under the bright lights of public scrutiny. As we slide ever deeper into the abyss of inequality, it's beginning to dawn on us that sinking the New Deal consensus wasn't the best idea after all. And he says, unfortunately, focusing on the money being mustered behind Hillary Clinton by various lobbyists and Wall Street figures misses the point. The problem with establishment Democrats is not that they have been bribed by Goldman Sachs and the banksters. It's that many years ago they determined to supplant the GOP as the party of Wall Street, and also to bid to favor the tech industry, big pharma, the telecoms, and the affluent professionals who toil in such places. So I'll link to Tom Frank's op-ed. I think you'll find it interesting and provocative. And I look forward to my next conversation with him, probably in March sometime. Every day I like to pause and thank the people who make this podcast possible with your subscriptions. People like Mark Brodsky, Dick Attlee, and Stephen Phillips just renewed his annual subscription. I'm grateful to each of you, and I want to invite others to come on in and support. As I've mentioned, because of some of my controversial coverage of the presidential race, the Oregon standoff, a few people have gone away and canceled their subscriptions in a bit of a huff. So I'd like you to replace them. And I really want to thank Natalie Reel and her husband out in Montana, who sent me a lovely email on Friday saying that they appreciated my coverage of the Oregon standoff. I have a new interview with Todd McFarlane that I'll tell you about in just a moment. But Natalie and her husband sent an extra contribution via PayPal over the weekend in their gesture to offset those who have left. So I want to invite you to join the team here at peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu link at the top of the homepage, follow it to become a subscriber, and it's very easy. And new annual subscribers earn a bonus gift if you're in the continental United States. It's a free copy of the fun new book called A Field Guide to the F Word by 94-year-old Ben Parker, who was featured in an in-depth interview recently. And I'd love to share a copy of that book with you if you just take out a new annual subscription and you're located in the continental U.S. So feel free to follow through with that. Now, while we're talking about support and those kinds of things, on Valentine's Day, I hope you tuned in to our telethon to launch NewsBud. And I want to thank, we saw people click in from all over the world, from Pakistan, from Italy, from England, from, Australia. It was exciting. And many points around the United States. And we're trying a very ambitious effort with a Kickstarter campaign to raise just under $1 million so that we can properly fund NewsBud, a new independent media outlet, for its first year of operation. We have 589 donors so far, totaling almost $57,000. Now, that's a great start, but we've got another $900,000 to go, and I need your help. So go to newsbud.com. There's a video there. There's information that'll take you to the Kickstarter page. It defines our mission, some of the key people who are already involved, your humble host included. And I urge you to support us either with a contribution or by sharing this information with like-minded individuals. And you may not be able to afford to contribute. We understand that. But you might be able to kick in some time to click around, share it on Facebook and Twitter, get your friends involved, encourage them to support it, because I think it's a really critical and exciting project, and I want to see it come to fruition. So the other way you can head in is if you just go to Kickstarter.com and under the project window where it says Search Projects, just put NewsBud, and it'll take you right to our page. Well, the war in the Middle East continues, and Russia engaged in another round of aerial attacks near the Aleppo area earlier in the last day or so. 50 people were killed in a recent airstrike, including many children. And this has put even more pressure on all of the parties to this extremely complicated and layered conflict. And today, Turkey is pressuring the United States and others to put ground troops into Syria. They're saying this is the only way we're going to turn the situation around. And of course, the Turks can't be trusted. Their agenda is not really focused on either the future of Syria or rousting the Islamic State. They're focused on trying to rub out the Kurds, particularly Turkish Kurds, and they are using this conflict to try to advance those goals. So I don't take this as a serious initiative, but it demonstrates that the situation is not going well for the interests of Western countries in this proxy war in Syria. And I don't think it's going to get better anytime soon. I got an interesting statement from an international peace group, which is called International Alert. And they're on the web at international.alert.org. And this is a group that is working to draw attention to what is looming as a new invasion of Libya by NATO-backed forces, including probably the United States. And this is because we're told that the Islamic State is setting up a base at Sirte and along areas of the oil exporting zone on the north coast of Libya on the Mediterranean. And Rebecca Crozier, who is the head of Middle East and North Africa programs at International Alert, says such an operation may well pose more problems than it solves. As we've seen in other contexts, for example, Afghanistan and Syria, airstrikes are not only insufficient, they may be counterproductive by giving additional legitimacy to forces being attacked and leading to new recruitment. And she added, adding war to war risks further inflaming the situation, increasing the number of civilian casualties, destroying more of the country's infrastructure, deepening divisions, and enabling ISIS to present itself as a resistance to the godless West, trying to get its hands on the country's oil reserves. Well, these are really thoughtful and powerful arguments. And here in the United States, nobody is listening. We are so wrapped up in our myopic presidential race, domestic politics, this Supreme Court showdown, that we're not paying attention to what's going on in the rest of the world. Nobody is really monitoring the activities of the Obama administration related to a new assault on Libya. And so the truth is, we really don't know what'll be next. And they might get around to telling us after they've launched military action. But the Congress is not on duty. The White House knows that they don't have to be straight with the American people, and they haven't been for a long time. And the media is not interested. Because, gosh, it'd be so expensive to send a reporter to Libya when all you got to do is follow Donald Trump, and he'll call Ted Cruz a pussy or do something to get the media all stirred up day after day after day. It's really sad to see how that's happening. I didn't get to see this, but on Sunday evening, the CIA director, John Brennan, a proven liar, went on 60 Minutes and blamed the attack by Islamic State fighters in Paris that killed 130 people on encryption. Now, this is a claim that, of course, will never be proven because he knows more than we do, and we're supposed to simply trust him. Brennan told 60 Minutes that the system was blinking red shortly before the attack started in the French capital. He said the intelligence agency was aware of an impending atrocity, but was unable to intercept encrypted messages the terrorists were using in the build-up to the massacre. So, this is just another thinly veiled effort to get us to give up our privacy rights and our Fourth Amendment rights to be free of government surveillance. We're supposed to conclude based on the unproven representations of a man who is proven to be untrustworthy that if we allow the government to snoop into our phones, monitor our communications, our email, anything else we do digitally, that they're going to be able to break up the next attack. And this is such insulting bullshit Because if the evildoers can't use text messaging on their phones to communicate with one another, they'll find another way to do it. And the idea that simply making all of us suspects and subject to Big Brother's snooping at any moment is going to permit them to prevent every future attack, it's just totally nonsensical. But that's what Brennan had to say and what 60 Minutes stenographically brought to us. Today I'm releasing to my subscribers an updated interview with Todd McFarlane. He is the rancher, lawyer, and activist who brought us a fascinating inside look at the occupation, the protest at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge near Burns, Oregon, that lasted for 41 days starting on January 2nd. And in my conversation with Todd McFarlane, he talks about the January 26th event, where a roadblock stopped two carloads of people and led to the shooting death of the self-styled spokesman for the group, Lavoie Finicum. And McFarlane represents the Finicum family as their attorney. Well, today it's announced that the group of 23 men and two women who participated in the protest are facing a federal felony charge of conspiracy to impede officers through force, intimidation, and threats. Now, I think these are really flimsy charges. And they also arrested the elder Bundy, Cliven Bundy, in Portland about a week ago. And they're bringing the same charges on him for the standoff in Nevada in 2014. And I have to say, I don't support the occupation. I don't support the motives of many of these misguided people. But I also don't support a government using tactics that led to the death of Finicum that might have been avoidable, and the infiltration of this protest group using the same tactics that they use in Muslim communities in this country to frame people. And one of the comments that I got from Todd McFarlane related to a guy who used the name Mark McConnell. And McConnell showed up a couple of days before January 26th, and on that day, he insisted on being the driver for Ammon Bundy to this meeting in the next county that they were headed to. And here's what McFarlane had to say about Mark McConnell.
What she told me is that this Mark McConnell, whoever he actually is, showed up there just like 2 days prior to the roadblock event, and so he just shown up just very recently. Now, whether he'd been there before, I've heard someone attempting to interview him and ask questions, and I think he made it sound like at some point early on he had gone there to try to extract someone else from the refuge that was there. Again, there may be some more backstory there that I don't completely understand, and it doesn't make complete sense to me. But He did arrive there. He was, I think, from my perspective, just taken into their confidences just amazingly easily. I don't know how he was able to gain kind of the access that he did as quickly and unvetted as he was, but for whatever reason, that happened. And then within just, say, 48 hours of his arrival, they were going to be traveling to Grant County to meet with the sheriff, among other things. And from what I understand, he absolutely insisted that he drive, that they go in his Jeep, and that Ammon was in his Jeep with him. Mm-hmm. And so they set it all up that way, and then he ends up driving up there, and when they hit the first roadblock, if you will, his vehicle is quickly swarmed by law enforcement vehicles. He pulls over and just acts pretty cooperative, and the next thing you know, that arrest occurs without incident. And it's my understanding that when this whole thing was said and done, yes, two people that in that whole scheme of things, and we could go down the list of people that were involved in those two vehicles, the two people basically that were let go and weren't held for further questioning or charging or anything else were Victoria Sharp, who was basically just dumped out in a Safeway parking lot in the middle of the night, and the other one was Mark McConnell, who was reunited with his Jeep, and away he went.
You can hear the full conversation with Todd McFarlane. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, and it'll be available soon at boilingfrogspost.com, part of my Processing Distortion podcast series. You know that I'm a big supporter of whistleblowers, and many of them have dedicated attorneys who deserve to be treated fairly. And I want to thank Carl Howard in Columbus, Ohio, who posted this article that I would not otherwise have seen. It's from the Corporate Crime Reporter organization, corporatecrimereporter.com, and it takes a look at the way lawyers who have represented whistleblowers often are threatened with discipline by the bar associations that they belong to. And their bar membership is critical to be able to do their jobs and make a living as an attorney. Well, for example, in the District of Columbia, the Disciplinary Council, which is the D.C. Bar's enforcement person, brought charges in June 2014 against the lawyer for Justice Department attorney, former Justice Department attorney Thomas Tam. That is Lynn Bernabe. And Bernabe and Notre Dame law professor Robert Blakey are being accused of advising their client to go public to reporters and law enforcement officials with incriminating and alleged confidential information against General Electric. Well, this is a whistleblower case. And we know that Thomas Tam was trying to expose illegal activity at the Justice Department. And the government didn't even attempt to charge him with misconduct. His activities were legally protected. In the case of Bernabe, the Department of Labor rejected the same charges when General Electric tried to censor her advocacy for the whistleblower in government proceedings. And one of the women I really respect is whistleblower lawyer Jesslyn Radak. And she commented that the Disciplinary Council in D.C. has a nasty history of politically motivated bar discipline, especially against whistleblowers and attorneys for whistleblowers. And Radak continues, like Tam, I blew the whistle as a Justice Department attorney. As with Tam, the federal criminal case against me closed with no charges ever being brought. Afterward, we both faced charges from the Maryland bar, which were dismissed. However, in my case, the D.C. bar charges hung like a sword of Damocles over my head for 10 years. And the D.C. bar is bringing charges against Tam 12 years after his revelation of the government's unconstitutional and illegal warrantless wiretapping program. I deplore the continuing crackdown on whistleblowers by Barack Obama. It is really inexcusable. And speaking of the president, he's developed a predictable pattern in the winter. He will come to San Francisco, rake in some campaign cash at a couple of fundraisers, fly to Los Angeles as he did on Friday, more fundraisers, he appeared on The Ellen Show, and then he took the weekend off and went to Palm Springs. And in the winter, Palm Springs is a lovely place. It was 90 degrees there on Saturday. And my friends Edna and Jim asked us to take care of their dog Bailey over the weekend because they were going to Palm Springs to play golf. And they knew that Obama was in the area, but that's all they knew when they showed up for their tea time Saturday morning at La Quinta. And they said that their golf bags disappeared in the pro shop for a few minutes and then showed up on a golf cart. And when they got to about the ninth or tenth hole, they were approached by the first of three Secret Service agents in golf carts, who came up with a metal detector, one of those handheld wands, and frisked them. Interestingly, they never examined the golf cart or looked in their golf bags. but they did check their persons three different times. And then they noticed that people who live along the golf course were starting to come out of their homes. And then they got word via Facebook that Obama was playing golf at La Quinta, and it turned out he was about three or four parties behind my friends. Now, they were not permitted to get very close to him. One of the members of their foursome took some videos, but they were on a phone and from about 75 feet away. But it was interesting to see. The president is tagging on his golf weekend with a two-day summit for friends from the Pacific Rim. China is explicitly not invited. And I don't begrudge the president some time off. Warm weather, a good golf game. I'm happy that they didn't close the course and shut my friends out, so that Obama and his pals could play. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. You're free to share this podcast with absolutely everyone, and I hope you will. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.